being here again for our second day on specifically looking at bills related to the subject primarily of medical liability reform issues. We have a list of, I think, how we're going to manage the witnesses today in an effort to try to ensure that everybody gets their opportunity to address the bills that are presented. With that in mind, I'm going to open a broad public hearing on all the bills that are set on today's schedules. The purpose of doing that is to obviously expedite the testimony so as people are wanting to talk about multiple bills, they can discuss those bills on the record without having to come up multiple times during the course of the hearing. So with the committee's indulgence, the chair would open a public hearing on House Bill 2492, 2493, 2494, 2495, 2496, 2497, 2498, and 2591. So public hearings now are open on all those bills. I would ask that both Dr. Nancy Johnson and Dr. Bernardo, if both of them would come forward right now, if they would please, and they can do their testimony. And Dr. Johnson, you're
yes.
welcome to go first.
Good afternoon, Mr. Williams, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Deborah Johnson, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you about the need for medical liability reform. This legislation's obviously a good start towards changing the legal climate that's brought us to medical liability and especially patient access crisis in Oregon. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist. I've been in Oregon for 12 years, and as of January 4th, I'm practicing gynecology only. The decision to no longer practice obstetrics was not arrived at without much agonizing, probably a two-year process. But ultimately, the local litigation climate and resultant rise in malpractice premiums has forced me to make this decision. I've shared more than a few tears with patients who I had to tell I could no longer care for during their pregnancies. I'm here to make a plea for common sense. Without reasonable changes in current legislation, women's access to obstetric care will become critically compromised. Already we're seeing real and significant changes in access to obstetric care. In the past several years, Salem has lost 9 obstetricians through retirement, death, change of practice emphasis, and moving from the state. We've been unable to replace these losses adequately. And now, recruitment efforts are mortally compromised by our litigation climate and failure to cap awards on non-economic damages. Physicians won't come here. The word's out. My staff and I see the results of our having fewer local obstetricians every day. Where I formerly accepted perhaps 3 to 4 patients a week for obstetric care, I'm now getting 80 to 100 calls per month from women who are seeking an obstetrician. It does no good to point fingers at who we think is most responsible. The problem's complex, with all players taking a part. But I see the solution is simple. Protect patients by continuing to cover medical economic damages, and protect your providers by limiting awards on non-economic damages. Despite what the current climate would have us believe, it has never been safer to have a baby. But in Oregon, it won't remain that way if women's access to prenatal care and delivery by qualified providers is crippled by their absence from the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Dr. Bernardo, do you want to go, and then we'll go ahead and open it for questions?
That'd be fine. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, I'm Peter Bernardo, a general surgeon here in Salem and currently chairman of the OMA's Medical Liability Reform Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak again with you today. And I'm speaking as a representative of the Oregon physicians and ultimately as an advocate for our patients, the citizens of our state. I'd rather not be here today. I spent 9 years training to be a surgeon. My skills lie in the hospital and in the clinic and in the operating room. Politics and law and the workings of legislature are still rather confusing to me, and I'm sure that's true of most of the Americans. But nonetheless, we have a crisis in our system in Oregon, in our healthcare system, and I'm here to speak about that. As Dr. Johnson has pointed out, as many other testimony has brought forward here in the last week and a half, Oregonians are having an increasingly difficult time finding trained physicians to tend to their health care needs. We're seeing shortages in obstetrical care, not just in rural Oregon, unless you want to consider Salem rural, but in Eugene and even now in the outlying areas of Portland. Neurosurgical care is disappearing up and down the I-5 corridor. I think many of this handouts yesterday, again, further data from the OMA survey of physician practices and what they plan to do in the coming year. There are not many neurosurgeons in this state, and to start losing a third or a half or have neurosurgeons cut back on what they practice would be devastating to care, particularly trauma care. It's not just specialists. We're short of physicians across the board in this state, and that's been true for many years. Family practice and pediatricians, as well as gastroenterology, cardiology, pulmonology. Recruiting and retaining physicians here in Oregon is an almost impossible challenge. I know. I've spent the last 4 years looking for a new associate. The reasons for that are multifactorial. We have poor reimbursement from Medicare and Medicaid and our own HMOs. The state economy is far from perfect, as you're all aware. Lack of money for schools and other public services all make this a state that talented, well-trained physicians don't necessarily want to come to. Over and above all of this, though, is the liability system and the crisis that we're approaching on this issue. As you've heard, Oregon's one of 12 states in the union that are facing this crisis. We're facing it in our own unique way, as is true for most other Oregon issues. Physicians across the state are having trouble finding affordable insurance or medical liability insurance at any cost. Others who have the insurance worry that a huge settlement or judgment over their limits might wipe out their future and the future of their children. And these are issues that they think about every day. It leads to defensive medicine, which increases the cost of care. It puts pressure on doctors to think about how they might need to change their practice and their practice parameters, to cut back on high-risk specialties, to retire early, or to leave. I had an associate here briefly who decided he'd be better off in Kansas, if you can imagine that. This ultimately, it's not a crisis of bad doctors. This is not about poor insurance company investments or mismanagement. Plain and simple, this is about large awards and a system which is horribly out of whack and out of balance. You have before you several bills which may bring some of the balance back to the system. Most of these bills are about fairness, about equitability, about not ambushing physicians, about not punishing a physician who is otherwise very competent. You need to remember that physicians day in and day out who are sued are good physicians. And if there is a bad outcome or one bad mistake, they have behind that dozens of decisions on a daily basis, which were well made, and hundreds or thousands of patients who support them and hope to see them the next day. Most of these bills represent issues which are already law in states across the union, states which have stable systems, states like California, states their physicians are moving to. And so I urge you to consider them. I urge you to refer them on to the full legislature with a recommendation for passage.
Thank you, Dr. Bernardo. Are there questions for either Dr. Johnson or Dr. Bernardo? Representative Shetterly.
Not just a question, but I want to report this man took my appendix last year.
And I believe it was ill, Representative.
He'd like him back.
I'm feeling much
Dr.
better. Thank you, Dr. Bernardo. Also, I want to welcome him and Dr. Johnson, who's a valuable member of our medical community in the Dallas area as well.
Any further questions for the panel? You know, the morning that you took his appendix, or later that day, I was driving down to a meeting he was supposed to chair here in the Capitol, Dr. Bernardo, and when I talked to him on the phone, he said, I think I've got the flu. I won't be able to be there. And later that day, you cut him open.
Yes, and then the next morning, he was in his room with a pile of papers and two briefcases conducting business. He was ready to go home.
The perfect patient, I should say.
Yeah, right. Okay. Anything else about your medical history?
No, thank you. Stop right there.
All right.
Doesn't HIPAA kick in here?
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate
your
testimony. Next, Mark Morrell and Stu Brown from the Procedure and Practice section of the Oregon State Bar.
Good afternoon. I brought with us a packet of submissions. They're in serial order beginning with House Bill 2491. My name is Mark Morrell, and I am the Procedure and Practice Chairman of the Committee at the Bar this year. And this is my colleague, Stuart Brown, and he is the Secretary. And I guess I should preface my remarks by saying, if you don't know about the Procedure and Practice Committee, we are a group of 14 lawyers equally composed of the defense bar and the plaintiff's bar. We have a sprinkling of judges on occasion. Currently, Judge Tennyson from Multnomah County is in our ranks. And the written materials that you have before you are the result of unanimous consensus among 14 lawyers, which may be the first time in my personal history that that has happened. We try and park our hats at the door when we come to the Procedure and Practice Committee, and we tend to follow our mission fairly closely, which is not to advocate substantive or moral decisions about the rightness or wrongness of the legislation, but merely to tell you in as clear terms as we can what the impact on the nuts and bolts day-to-day procedure and practice will be. So with that in mind, we're going to kind of tag team this thing and go through the seven or eight pieces of legislation we have before us today. I will talk about 2492 first. We have a one-page submission that we have presented to you. I will not read it. I will share with you our thoughts. We're taking a neutral position on this piece of legislation, and we're asking only that you understand that we have some serious concerns about the one-year rollback provision being eliminated. The doctor that came before me indicated that the system lacked balance, and we were trying to give some balance to the system. Eliminating the rollback provision, I think the committee should note that this was a historically in 95, this was a provision that they made when they did away with, or when you did away with, joint liability and went to the several liability system. And it was an attempt to provide some balance if, for some reason, one of the defendants was found to be could not collect against them, or the judgment was found to be uncollectible against that defendant. You could go back to the court and say, I want a reallocation, or I want some help on this. And our committee talked about this, and we focused on society's idea of who is responsible for assisting in curing the injury. Does the plaintiff have to go out and collect his own judgment, or does a defendant with superior assets, skills, and experience is he better and more efficient at going and collecting from his joint tortfeasors? That is, he pays the whole tab or some of it, and then he goes and gets money from the others who he paid for. That, in a sense, is the balancing question. Our committee has declined to talk about the substance of the bill and whether or not that's a good idea, and whether or not joint or several liability is a good idea. But we did have some serious concerns about eliminating the balance that's interposed by the subsection that would be eliminated under the current legislation. It's a matter of burden. Who should have the burden for collecting or evening up the score? Is it the injured person only, or is it a combination of the parties who were involved? And that seems to us to be the issue. I don't know, Mr. Chairman, whether you want to do all the questions at the end and we'll just roll through this stuff, or do you want to go by bill?
Why don't we just break at the end of each bill so we can stay focused and timely so that
people fine. Can... that's the balance of my comments on 2492.
Okay, then I want to open it up to the committee if they've got questions on 4992. Representative Sheriff.
Just I'm glad to hear some of the history of that. I mean, you were committee staff in 95. I wasn't here in 95, but...
I was.
This is one of these... term limit issues that thankfully we won't have so much in the future, but I don't think we have anybody that was here. Floyd, were you here in 1995? Yeah. I do know, though, as having come just in 97, that with the echoes of that tort reform session still reverberating down the halls, that was a pretty intensive effort to, I think, as you said, achieve some balance in some major tort reform efforts in 1995. So I appreciate the history lesson here and how we got to where we are in the current statutes.
Okay. Anybody else? Representative Anderson.
Just one comment that I picked up on, that generally it's the plaintiff who is poor and the defendant that is quite well-to-do or something along that line. And if it's my understanding, having come out poor as a church mouse from dental school, a lot of the physicians come out with huge loan packages that they have to pay over a number of years before they finally catch up and start making some money. So a young surgeon, a neurosurgeon, highly trained, may have some major financial problems, and then to be added the risk of major suit could really be a factor in his determining whether he wants to practice here at all.
Oh, it's very expensive to be a professional in the United States, especially to begin with.
Right.
I know that myself. What my comments meant to suggest, and not to one side or the other, there are large, make no mistake about it, there are large, well-organized, rich corporations who are also plaintiffs, and there are also poor defendants. My position is no matter where the power is, the court should be able to allocate the duty to collect for the injuries or duty to make it right between the more powerful of the parties if that's to the advantage of the injured party.
Good.
Thank you.
Anything else? Okay, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. First of all, I'd like to apologize for forgetting to turn off my cell phone. That was inexcusable. And
that's right. If it happens one more time, we just all get to share it for a day. Pass it around and...
The next bill is House Bill 2493. This is a bill that concerns expert witness testimony and who may testify as an expert. Again, the committee was unanimous with regard to this bill. The committee believes that a finder of fact, whether it be a judge or a jury, benefits from reliable and relevant testimony. We believe that this bill brings some order to what in the past has been a somewhat chaotic interpretation of the evidence code with regard to expert witnesses. The committee does have some concerns, however. The first concern has to do with scientific testimony. The law in Oregon with regard to scientific testimony has been fairly well developed. There are two seminal cases, the Brown and O'Keefe cases that people talked about yesterday. They have developed some pretty specific and pretty rigorous tests for an expert witness. The committee is concerned that this bill might weaken those standards or cause the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court to revisit scientific testimony. That is a concern. There is a possible way to address that concern if the Judiciary Committee or the House feels it appropriate to mention in debate on the floor and presentation of the bill that this is not intended to change existing Oregon law with regard to scientific testimony. We are also somewhat concerned about the additional time that will be taken up with vetting expert witnesses at trial, but all of us who are trial attorneys have been through this, and it is not something that takes days or weeks to accomplish. We feel that the obtaining of reliable and relevant testimony is more important than the time spent weeding out that testimony, which is neither relevant nor reliable. Our last concern is that there be a distinction between scientific testimony and that testimony taken as an expert witness or from an expert witness for technical knowledge or, I think the term is, other specialized knowledge. While the first testimony is based on scientific principles and the scientific method and requires rigor in determining whether the witness and what he or she is saying meets scientific principles, the latter two do not. And what we are hoping is that the courts can bring some order to this by applying some of the factors used in federal courts for these latter two types of expert witnesses without requiring the same rigor that they would for a scientific witness. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions on 2493?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My practice is limited to prosecution, so I'm not in the civil arena. So I did speak with a couple of individuals. My understanding that these type of cases where you do have expert testimony, is there's a Rule 104 motions, I guess, hearings. Can you elaborate on that? Because my understanding from this individual I spoke with, that's an area that is pretty well defined in Oregon. Has a long, extensive, as you said, case law that's been developed in Oregon, and the concern is that if you make a shift to the federal system, that you are basically going to undercut what has already been there, and that they felt that the system that's in place now works well, and it is the has the basis of Oregon decisions.
For scientific evidence, I think you're correct. The issue comes up at trial. When you have an expert witness, and in state court, oftentimes you don't know who the expert witness is. You don't know even if there's going to be an expert witness until the other side calls their expert witness. The issue will come up when the witness starts to testify, starts to give an opinion. The lawyer will then object and ask for permission from the court to ask questions of the expert witness to establish the bona fides of the expert. Whether the expert in fact is an expert and whether the opinion is based on facts. If you know who the expert is and what their testimony might be prior to trial, then you can file what's called a motion in limine prior to trial. Both of these take time, and they take judicial resources to accomplish. I think those of us who practice feel that this is time well spent, because you're determining whether the witness, who's not a fact witness, has nothing to say about the actual facts themselves, whether they occurred or did not occur, whether that witness will add something that the trier of fact can use in making a decision. Will there be a change? It depends on how far this committee and the House and the Senate go in moving towards the federal rules. The federal rules also require disclosure of expert witnesses, and the federal rules also require the giving of expert reports to the other parties, and they allow for the possible deposition of expert witnesses. So if you know beforehand who the experts are, then you'll be filing many more motions ahead of trial and, again, taking more time for the courts in deciding these motions. Whichever way is used, I think we on the committee feel comfortable that this bill will help the court make a decision. Those hearings will be held anyway. The objections will be made in any event by the lawyers because we're objectionable kind of people. But this bill will provide some standards that the court may use in determining whether that testimony and whether those objections are well-founded.
I would remind the committee, Mr. Chairman, and members, that of yesterday's testimony, where Mr. Wolbrock and Mr. Miller and a variety of Mr. Hoffman talked about the two different systems. We're going to urge the members of this committee not to mix the systems because these systems were developed to be balanced and fair through their history of court decisions and statutes. There was tit-for-tat sort of balancing. In Oregon, we're required to plead with specificity what happened to us, to tell the court in a complaint everything that happened and how it happened, so everybody knows the theory. In federal court, where I do a lot of practicing, we say, I got hurt, it happened on this date, and you did it. And that's about it. We just notify them that there's a beef. And then before trial, everybody works out the details. In state court, they know the beef up front, and everybody goes gets their witnesses, and everybody comes to court and has it out on that day. Now, the two systems are efficient in their own special ways and cause problems in their own special ways. But they are succinct systems because of the approach that they have to the fact-finding. Who makes the call? For example, the problem you're going to get into is if you mix the two systems. In Multnomah County, I don't know who my judge is for trial till the day before the trial. And so all the pretrial stuff could be a variety of judges, some actually elected, some pro tem. The pretrial calendar, or pretrial motion calendar in Multnomah County, you could, any of 500 judges could show up. And you may have five or six judges making the same decision on the same deal before it gets to trial. So what happens when the judge gets to trial and says, well, Judge Bob threw it all out, and I really want to see it. Well, you know, that's a problem. In the federal system, when I file a case in Portland or Medford or Eugene, I am assigned a trial judge. The trial docket number has his initials at the end, and he's the judge for the whole thing. Now, you can obviously see that there are going to be differences in approaches, but I'm cautioning this committee that mixing the two can cause problems which my committee is very afraid of in terms of leaving somebody out or leaving some door unhooked. Now, Oregon and New York, according to Mr. Wolbrock and Mr. Miller, are the envy of litigators. I litigate in federal court and in state court, and I will tell you that the amount of money spent in just the arguing about the experts doubles the cost of litigation in federal court. Because you got to tell them what they're going to tell them, and then you got to tell them what they told them. And our lawyers will argue about everything.
And, Mr. Chairman, Representative Prozanski, with this particular bill, does not change the procedure of challenging an expert witness or the expertise of the expert witness. All it does is establish criteria that the judge can look to once the expert has been challenged. The next bill goes a little further in that regard.
Uh, 2494 is the adoption of the federal rule, and my comments aren't any different substantively about the two systems. I would caution you that there are a minority of cases for the everyday lawyer that will bring these into play. For example, in a motor vehicle accident, less than $50,000 damage, we're going to arbitration. The insurance company had the plaintiff looked at by an independent medical examiner. We know what his opinion is. We know what the treating doctor's opinion is. We know what the deal is. We know how much money they're asking for. So we go to the hearing and we cross-examine the witnesses about what they do and don't know. And there's no surprises. Where it gets more difficult are the complex cases, medical malpractice, products liability, where you are going to have experts coming in talking about what other experts think, and it becomes dueling experts. Our committee talked about a variety of problems raised by this legislation. Most of it has to do with dollars related to the extra hearings, and that concerns us greatly.
If I can, I guess I want to ask a question, and it relates to, and I practice both in state and federal court, so I've done the expert discovery both ways. And as we heard yesterday, we're really, you know, two of the 50 states that don't do the discovery of experts in some form ahead of time. And yet, I seem to get a sense that most of the insurance folks, at least on the defense side, who actually write the checks to, you know, people who practice on the defense side, seem completely supportive of this concept. And so to the extent that it really did increase overall cost of the litigation, they must envision there in some way that the knowledge about the expert and the value of getting the expert's information ahead of time, either to help convince them to get the case settled early or to provide them the necessary ammunition they might need at the time of trial to appropriately cross-examine the expert, is worth that additional cost. Were it not so, it seems to me that they would all be in here telling us that this was a horrible idea and that it would increase their cost of litigation. So I guess to the extent that it exists in 48 other states and it's the industry that's primarily writing the check to pay for at least the defense side of this litigation, saying that they think it's a good idea, I guess I'm struggling a little bit to understand and wonder if our opposition to this issue is lawyers who have mostly all grown up and been raised and practice in Oregon is somewhat provincial.
It's hard to tell what a particular group of people is thinking. I will agree with what you said, that it makes sense. I think that changes depending on the economic risk of the cases. I think you're going to get to a point where if you require expert testimony to be disclosed prior to the trial, you're going to greatly complicate the process and thereby drive out some of the smaller cases. They just won't become worthwhile, and that's troubling to me. Now, if we can tie this in a sort of maximum way to other parts of the statutes where we can say, okay, maybe we should raise the attorney's fees allowance in 20080, get it up above $5,500, or maybe we should build in some insurance to the low-end people, because the statistics will show you that, just as an example, motor vehicle accidents. Most of the motor vehicle accidents are not life-threatening injuries. They're pernicious, annoying, disruptive, costly, and those people need some help. But if they have to spend, if their lawyers have to spend roughly double the time pre-trial, in a case that probably won't get tried, just exchanging documents about expert witnesses, it's not going to become cost-effective. And that's what we're worried about. On both sides of the fence, some of these won't be defensible. And that's really sad, too, where somebody's reputation takes a hit because their insurance company or their defense counsel couldn't justify spending the amount of time it was to solve a $15,000 claim.
But I guess I go back to the point that I made, which at least in 48 other states, this seems to function without a complete destruction of their justice system, nor have I read any articles suggesting that small claims or smaller size claims in those states aren't being prosecuted or that people are getting their justice denied because there's a requirement of expert disclosure. And I suspect if I hauled in, you know, 15 lawyers or 20 lawyers who practice in states where this goes on, they tell me that it's incorporated into part of their practice, that they figured out after a while how to be efficient at doing it, that the state requirements probably don't require the same level of detail that the federal requirements do under some sort of a pretrial order approach. And I guess I just disagree with your assertion that it would double the cost of pretrial preparation to identify the name of your expert and what that person's going to testify on, because I haven't had a trial yet, either in state court or federal court, where at some point in my own materials that I had to prepare in advance of pretrial or in a report to my client, that I didn't have to do that work anyway, that it wasn't already identified.
Oh, I can't disagree with you, Mr. Chairman. I'll go back to my original comment, is be careful if we're going to start mixing systems. If we're going to go to the full-blown federal notice pleading where we just tell them it's up and figure it out before trial and go in there, well, that's one way to do it. The other way to do it is say, look, the trial is going to be the deciding, the place where the decision is made. I don't believe any lawyer who has a good case isn't willing to share it with the other side most of the time, with the exception of maybe one or two witnesses. I mean, we're all going to put our best cards on the table to see if we want to get it settled, because it's much easier to settle cases than it is to try them. So whether the 48 states are right or whether New York or Oregon are right is not my job here, and I don't pretend to be smart enough to figure it out. But I do know that if you mix the two systems, we're going to have trouble, because the balance that protects both sides will be upset.
Okay. Anything else?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
Yesterday I expressed concern about what strikes me as one of the sort of overriding concerns about the medical malpractice system, which is that such a relatively small proportion of the premium was paid in premiums by our physicians winds up being provided to victims. And it strikes me that it's the costs of advocacy that are tending to soak up so much of what is being paid out, both in contingency fees for the advocacy on behalf of the plaintiff, and on the defense side, it's the difference between premium dollars paid out and what's paid to victims is a function of administration and profit by the insurance company, but the rest is really cost of defense. So I'm going to ask these witnesses the same question I asked of the last panel yesterday, which is, would in the case of these two bills, 2493 and 2494, would these tend to increase the costs of advocacy, to reduce the costs of advocacy, or would they be neutral?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, I don't believe that 2493 by itself introduces any extra costs. All it does is provide standards to the court in ruling as to whether the expert's testimony goes to the finder of fact or not. So I don't believe that 2493 would add costs. 2494 is a bill that has two components. The first is expert disclosure. I like to know who the experts are on the other side. I would like to know generally what they're going to testify to. I know in all of my cases, and I do pretty much only commercial litigation, I know what that expert is going to say. And I can find out on the Internet in 1 hour everything there is to know about that expert, and I don't have to take discovery of the expert to find that out. So expert disclosure itself might be a good thing, and it might not cost a lot of money. In terms of advocacy, it will take me another couple of hours to do a search. Maybe I'll want to find some depositions the expert has given or some trial testimony that the expert has given. But by and large, it's not going to cost a lot of money. I think where the money comes in the expert witness discovery. Once you are requiring the expert witness to do a detailed statement of his or her opinions, the foundations, provide documents, then you get depositions. That's where the real costs come in. And For those of us who are trial lawyers, when I get into court and I have an expert witness on the stand, probably 25% of the time I will cross-examine the expert on the area of his or her expertise. Only about 25% of the time. Because I know that expert witness will kill me if I go after them because they're good. That's what they do for a living. So, you know, you can take all the depositions in the world, and in most cases, you may never use the deposition at all. Will it be expensive to require expert witness discovery as opposed to disclosure? Yes, it will. But that is a policy decision that the legislature must make.
Mr. Morrell, do you have a...
I would agree wholeheartedly with him and only put one thing into the mix. Part of the idea behind expert disclosure, to be perfectly fair, is to decide whether they're going to go forward in the trial. Okay? It's not only just finding out, it's also a function of getting rid of that testimony through Rule 104 hearings and saying he's not competent, he doesn't know what he's doing. Okay? There may be some savings on the end of that because the trial will then be shorter because there'll be fewer witnesses. That doesn't happen very often. In all candor, the reasoning that goes behind the federal system is you get it all ironed out before the jury's in the box and the judge is there and the lights are turned on and we're ready to go. Now, in most of the cases, you can come to a trial with a jury and a judge, and the judge can make the decisions as he goes, using the entire trial as the context of whether or not these cases or this particular expert is relevant or competent. To remove it from that arena is kind of trying to decide who's going to be third base without being have the rest of the team there at the time. You know, you're picking your players weeks in advance of the game. Sometimes that makes sense, sometimes it doesn't. But that's basically the problem you're stuck with in terms of financial.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're very welcome. We're going to need to pick up the pace, gentlemen in committee, a little bit if we're going to get through.
We do not have a statement on 2495 other than we believe it is an access to justice problem. 2496, I believe, is collateral benefits to be deducted from the verdict. I understood the comments to mean that this would apply to more than just the medical profession or cases against medical providers. Is that true? Was this one of the bills that it was going to apply to everybody?
Yeah, sheet. I'm not sure I can answer that myself without looking.
If it doesn't, that was one of our concerns.
Right, Representative Shedd.
Yeah, that's in sub 2, line 17 to 20. It says the provisions of section 1 apply to claim for personal injury, death, including claims, emotional injury, distress, etc., based on alleged negligence of a person who is licensed by the Board of Medical Examiners or the State Board of Nursing. So it appears to be limited to medical and nursing cases.
There was a comment yesterday that was made related to putting money in the plaintiff's pocket. I think this bill does just the opposite. What they're suggesting here is if a plaintiff recovers in a personal injury case and has received benefits from a collateral source, let's say disability insurance, he gets whacked, run over, goes to the hospital, spends 2 months at home, he gets 2 months disability, comes back to work, settles the case, or goes to trial, should the disability benefits that he receives for his injuries be deducted from the verdict against the defendant? Now, this bill says if he paid for it himself, no. But if it was given to him as a benefit, yes. And I can only characterize the discussion of our committee as saying, wait a minute, anybody can do an end run around that. You just go to the work and you say, boss, give me the money in my check and I'll pay the insurance premium rather than you pay my insurance as a part of of my package. So that seems to me, or seems to our committee, to be sort of an unnecessary hurdle or something that's actually fairly ineffective unless we can figure out how to prevent that. The other side of the coin in our discussion was, well, wait a minute, whether your company pays for it or they give you the money and you pay for it, you still earned it. You're still out there digging the hole, and they're paying you $50 an hour to dig the hole. The rule in Oregon has always been, if you had a deal with an insurance company whereby you had an extra policy of insurance and that was a collateral benefit, collateral to the verdict, that was your business. And without deciding whether or not that's good, this committee says this will be the end of the collateral benefit rule. And that is a major change in the way we do business in Oregon. And it does nothing but take money out of the plaintiff's pocket.
Okay, are there questions? Yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seems to me we're losing the before and after tax issue with your example, though. One issue, it's the premiums paid with before tax. The other issue, it's paid with after tax, which is not inconsequential.
No, not at all. I agree.
Anyone else? Representative McPherson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know this is much a question, so I don't know that necessarily need a response, but I did want to just get out into the sort of the discussion that I think the area that's going to have the greatest impact among the cases that are sources of benefit that are described is health insurance. That is, it's very typical when an injured party becomes injured, they have health benefits extended by their employer or a spouse's employer, and that what this bill would do is, in effect, subtract whatever that is from the award that would be made to the injured party. So in effect, it's taking, and oftentimes the employer has a provision for offset. In fact, it's very common in employer health plans to have a provision that says that the plan does not cover injuries, the cost of medical care for injuries that are caused by a third party, and then the plan extends that coverage on condition that it be reimbursed out of any judgment or settlement that's entered. And if I'm understanding this bill correctly, it would attempt to prevent that operation, because if the premiums were paid provided by the employer as opposed to by the employee, it would be attempting to prevent that, not have that included in the judgment that's being entered. So I just make that as an observation. And I will also point out that I think who pays for health insurance benefits is becoming an increasingly slippery issue because of cafeteria plans and other mechanisms by which people elect coverage and salary reduce. So I don't necessarily need a response unless there was something more the witnesses had to offer.
Okay. Representative Sherrilling.
Also, just an observation, if they want to respond or not, but as I look in sub 3, it says that evidence of these collateral benefits can be considered by the trier of fact, and it's the evidence is admissible at trial. It almost suggests to me that this would have a kind of a doubling effect. You would have the introduction of these collateral benefits to the jury, I suppose, which I think would at least tend to have the effect of reducing a jury award where the jury is aware of these other collateral benefits. I mean, they're going to take that into account. And then once that award is entered, you're reducing the award by the actual dollar amount. And it seems to me that there could be a kind of a double whammy here by the introduction of these collateral benefits to the jury and then the post-verdict reduction of any judgment by the actual dollar amount of collateral benefits.
Well, both of you gentlemen are correct in that the current proposal can leave out or double charge a participating provider, depending on the squeeze play. Subrogation is an issue. The payback provisions of health care plans are an issue. ERISA, the Employment Retiree Income Security Act, that's an issue because a lot of this is going to be held to be federal legislation. We're very concerned that we haven't really connected all the dots on this one yet. It's about the best I can tell you. I'm going to go to 2497.
Okay.
This law modifies the laws relating to comparative negligence. I apologize for the format of which we have given you our written statement. It's not our usual product, but Bob Carey from Baron Liebman worked very hard on this and got it to me at the last minute, hence its format as an email. I apologize for its informality, but to save time, we are a little concerned about the nuts and bolts of this particular bill, the way it modifies the current ORS 18470. Mr. Carey has been kind enough to provide us with some assumptions and with some little fact scenarios that show that this can get to be real complicated. And somebody in the committee meeting last Friday said, in my committee meeting, said, welcome to the land of the 42-page verdict form. And it may be that complicated. And I would urge the committee to take a hard look when you have a minute about some of these examples, and you can see how things can get away from a trial judge in terms of this new scenario. One of the questions is does the election by one defendant bind all the other defendants? Let's say you have a five-car pileup on I-5 going north, and number one car gets hurt, number two car gets hurt, number three car gets hurt, and everybody sues the guy that hit him from behind. Well, if one of those defendants elects to say, well, I want the settling defendant in or out, does that preclude a veto by the other defendants? And what happens is I'm defending car number three, and I really like my chances of saying it was all the fault of car number four. Well, car number four settles with the plaintiff, and they're gone. Now they can't come back into the trial, or that they can, or somebody makes the call that they want them in or out. I sat around a table with about 12 out of the 14 lawyers on my committee, and everybody's eyes were about the size of saucers going, whoa, you know, I'm not sure I want that judgeship now. And it does pose some fairly serious problems related to that. And that's about, without getting into the heart of this matter, that's about really all I have to say
okay.
At this juncture.
Are we done?
Next bill.
Last one is 2498, is that right?
Actually, there are two more. 2498, Mr. Chairman, is the bill on interest rates. The committee is concerned about this bill because it applies to only two types of defendants. What we would like would be to see this bill applied to all defendants in civil cases.
And I think I heard the proponents actually in their testimony yesterday indicate that that's a change that they would recommend as well.
I believe Mr. Crew said that, yeah. Mr. Chairman, and we would support that, and we would support the bill if that change were made. Otherwise, we would oppose it. 2591 is the installment payment bill. This is a bill that has some problems. Interestingly enough, in the materials yesterday, I saw that this bill had there was some representation that this particular bill worked well in the state of California. I got a copy of the California bill last night, and by and large, California statute, it's I believe Code of Civil Procedure 667.7, addresses many of the concerns that our committee has with regard to this particular bill. First of all, the bill will complicate trials. The plaintiff is going to have to differentiate in its proof between pre- and post-judgment damages, both economic and non-economic. It's not something that is done at the present time. the jury is also going to have to differentiate in its verdict form. There's a statute, ORS 18.570, should be amended. It's not proposed to be amended. This is a problem. And all of this ignores the obvious, which is that how can a jury or a judge make a determination as to what the post-judgment damages of the plaintiff are going to be when there is no judgment entered, and we don't know when the judgment is going to be entered. The California statute contains no reference to judgment, and it might be worth looking at. Secondly, the bill, unlike the California bill, establishes no guidelines for the court in setting up the installment plan. At least the California bill has some legislative intent that addresses what the legislature wants the judge to be doing. The Oregon bill has no such guidelines. The decision of the judge, if it's reviewable at all, is going to be reviewable only for an abuse of discretion, which is a pretty high standard. So the committee should be aware of that. If no standards are included in the bill, it's going to take the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court a number of cases to do these, and that will take them a couple of years. And in the meantime, we're going to have cases that will have been tried with no standards at all. So we would urge that standards be set forth either by the drafters of the bill or by the legislature. A real problem that's led to an opposition by the debtor-creditor committee, the Oregon State Bar, is that the judgment cannot be docketed and cannot form a lien on the real property of the defendant. California statute addresses this by stating that if the defendant is uninsured, then or only partially insured for the amount of the judgment, then the defendant will be required to post security for the remaining amount. In the Oregon bill, 2591 makes this discretionary with the judge. The judge can require security. The judge does not have to require security. We believe that if the bill cannot form a lien on the assets of the debtor, that there should be security required by the court, and that this security should be bankruptcy proof in terms of its application. The last thing anyone wants to have happen is a nice judgment set up and scheduled out, and all of a sudden the defendant declares a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And, of course, then the plaintiff is left without being able to perfect their judgment. The bill specifically states that it's not subject to modification except as provided by a specific Oregon rule. Our question is, what does this do to the ability of the appellate courts to review it? Common sense would dictate that, of course, the appellate courts can review any judgment of the trial court, but from time to time, our appellate courts have been very strict in their interpretation of statutes, looking at the actual language of the statute. And it would not surprise me to see our Supreme Court look at this language and perhaps reach a conclusion other than, of course, it's reviewable by the appellate courts. Those are the comments that we have with regard to this particular bill that we think will cause problem in its application, and we would urge the committee, if it is going to seriously consider the installment payment issue, that it look at statutes from other states, specifically the one in California that was referenced in some of the materials yesterday, because I think this will provide some guidance as to what a bill should contain. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate both of your testimony. If there isn't any questions of the panel on this last bill, then I'm going to excuse them. And again, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we'll bring up the next panel, Mick Alexander and Rich Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I have some written testimony, if I can have it distributed. My name is Nick Alexander. I'm a local attorney in practice, and I'm also the current president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm here actually to try to actually address a couple of bills specifically, 2492 and 2497, which are interrelated and I think can be spoken to jointly. And I want to talk about 2492 and joint and several just in a basic example. And I want to talk a little bit about the history, which I've outlined in the written materials and I hope is fairly clear. And Mr. Lane will also focus specifically on what happened in 1995 when the current version of the statute was passed. But yesterday we heard, and we often hear, that several liability is only fair because people should only bear their responsibility, their individual responsibility for any kind of injury. The social issue and the policy issue that's addressed by joint and several liability is really not that. Historically, it's always been who should bear the risk of insolvency of a defendant, of an at-fault party. Should that risk of insolvency be borne by the innocent plaintiff or by another at-fault defendant? And I use the term innocent plaintiff because historically, all throughout the law, plaintiffs were originally barred from recovery at all if they were at fault in any degree. And liability has always been several only under our law if the plaintiff's fault was greater than that of any defendant. So if I use innocent and at fault, I think that it's applicable under all states of our law. And I also think it's important for the members of the committee to understand that when we talk about joint liability, we really talk about an interrelationship of fault, which is not quite as easily separated as one might think. And I'll give you an example which I don't think is necessarily far-fetched. You're in your car, or your spouse is in the car, and you're parked in front of the, or you're stopped in front of the railroad crossing, and the bars are coming down, and there's a train approaching. And a car comes and doesn't stop and hits you in the rear and punches you about a third of the way forward towards the tracks. Then another car comes and hits that car, and that hits you and punches you another third of the way toward the tracks. You're still safe. But then a third car comes, have another collision, pushes you out onto the railroad tracks, the train comes, and you're killed. Now, two of those cars have minimum policies of $25,000. One of them has $5 million in coverage. You have $450,000 in medical expenses, and the matter goes to trial, remembering that but for the acts of all three of those defendants, your car would have never gone onto the tracks. You can take anyone out, your car wouldn't have gone onto the tracks, and you'd still be alive. So the jury awards $1.2 million, $450,000, plus that's your past medical expenses, plus lost wages and plus pain or loss of society and companionship for your death. Now, what does the plaintiff recover? Despite the fact that all defendants contributed and that the accident would not have happened and the death wouldn't have occurred without the combined negligence of all of them, well, it's $25,000 from each of the two defendants with only that much insurance, assuming that they have no other assets, which is generally the case. And from the third defendant, who has $5 million in coverage, he gets $400,000, assuming the jury finds one-third, one-third, one-third at fault. And how does that work under the proposed statute? That's all the money he recovers, because the defendant with $1 million in coverage, even though the accident would not have occurred, even though the death would not have happened without that negligence, he's relieved of liability, and the insolvency, the risk of insolvency of those other defendants falls on the innocent plaintiff. And it's really even worse than that, because he recovers $450,000, and his medical expenses were $450,000, and under the state of the law in Oregon, insurance companies always get paid first. So in my case, the insurance companies get reimbursed. The plaintiff's family gets nothing. The at-fault party, who was an integral part in this tragedy, his insurance company is relieved of liability because he is able to pass that risk of insolvency off onto the innocent plaintiff's family. That's the way that joint and several liability works in the real world and the way things happen. And so it may be nice to say, well, it's only fair, I only should bear my part of fault. But the issue is who bears the risk of insolvency. That's always been the issue. It's still the issue. And if you make it several only, as this bill proposes, without reallocation, then the example that I gave will be exactly what happens. And now it happens, incidentally, with obviously unless you're greater than 25% fault. So that's the social issue. And this matter has been discussed, and as I said, Mr. Lane will talk about it in more detail, and I tracked the changes in the written materials that I gave you from the 70s when we started comparative fault to 1985, where we changed joint and several liability once, to 1995, when this was a huge discussion in this legislative body, and the current statute was proposed and adopted as a good compromise between joint and several liability and several liability only, so a compromise was reached with the 25% at fault threshold for allocation, something that was discussed and to my knowledge has never created a problem. I don't know of, and I can say with some certainty, that no case has reached our appellate courts that have found it necessary to interpret this reallocation provision. And to my knowledge, I have not even heard an anecdotal story about reallocation being a problem in the trial court or, in fact, having ever occurred. So the statute, I mean, kind of, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I don't know what the clamor is to change this statute, which was passed with a lot of deliberation and with the help of counsel at the time, and it was a compromise. So House Bill 2492 is not only unnecessary but unfair. 2497 has two components. One allows a jury to consider fault of non-parties. And again, our law has been expanded in the past years so that the jury now has the opportunity to consider the fault of multiple parties in the same proceeding. All defendants that the plaintiff names can be compared and are on the verdict form. Settling defendants who used to be off the verdict form are now left on the verdict form for comparison. And third-party defendants, meaning that if a defendant feels that someone else is at fault, there are very liberal rules to allow that defendant to bring in a third-party defendant. So if he feels that he is being unnecessarily burdened with this fault, and that it should be cast on someone else, we have a very, very liberal and effective rule of what we call third-party practice so that that third-party defendant can be brought into the mix. Works very well. Now, we want to be able to compare the fault of non-parties. Non-parties. There is no provision of how these are brought in, when they are brought in, or how we even know who they are, or when we know who they are. But the idea that one defendant can perhaps say some stranger to the litigation who has no responsibility to pay any judgment can shoulder my fault, I can blame them, is in my opinion not warranted. It also is a hotbed for collusion. Can you imagine this? A defendant, whether it's medical or not, a defendant comes up and say 2 days before trial, hey, you can't get hit with this judgment. Come take the fall, would you? So they bring in somebody. I don't know when we're being told about who this party is. You're talking about disclosure of experts. I'm talking about disclosure of a party. So the party comes in and says, you know, it's never came out before, but I confess. You know, I'm the one at fault. I'm the guy. I did it on my shoulders. If that is an appropriate judicial procedure, I doubt very much that it is. The other provision of 2497 is that now a defendant can elect, how a settling defendant is going to be treated. Now, under our prior law, it was clear what happened. If someone settled, there was a credit. There was an offset to any judgment that was entered. That law changed in 1995 after very much deliberation and after considering the effects of the alterations in joint and several liability that we had done. And so now they decided that the settling defendant would remain on the verdict form and the jury would just make its determination of fault and award a judgment. This new law wants a defendant, and instantly the comment by practice and procedure was very interesting and one I hadn't thought of, like a lot of things I don't think of, but you know what happens when you have multiple defendants and one wants them off the verdict form and one wants them on the verdict form? I don't know what happens. But now the defendant has the option, and let's say there's only two defendants, so we'll make my example simple. Well, as a plaintiff, if you are bringing a case against multiple defendants, you have reasons to settle. And one thing you want to be able to do is plan your trial strategy based upon your settlement. And planning that trial strategy means you're going to know, is the defendant on the verdict form or off the verdict form? And you should at least have that opportunity. Now it's taken away from the person who's trying to settle with one of the defendants, and that's going to discourage settlement. And I know the defendant is going to say, well, but what happens is that there's two defendants in the case, and then the plaintiff settles at the last minute with one defendant, and I can't get my case together to blame the person who left. Well, you know, if that defendant thought his co-defendant was at fault, he should have filed a cross-claim against that defendant, or been prepared to do so if, tactically speaking, he thought that would not be a good approach to take. The truth of who's at fault doesn't vary by who settles. So if that's your position, be prepared to assert it. If tactically you don't want to assert it, it's not my fault as the plaintiff, nor should it be your option of what to do with my settlement. So neither of these bills, in my opinion, are proposals that improve the administration of justice in any way. I think that House Bill 2492 is unnecessary and unfair, and 2497 is a procedural morass that will do nothing but discourage settlement and inhibit the efficient administration of these cases.
Great, thank you. Why don't we go ahead and have Mr. Lane make his comment.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be brief on 2492 and 97. I would hand up for the committee's consideration, there was a reference made yesterday or last week about the 1995 legislative session and the background regarding the joint and several. And as Mr. Alexander has referred to, that issue of joint and several liability in this state was one of the more significant issues of the 1995 session. Senator Bryant and Representative Williams, chair of this committee, took great pains to get as many interested parties into a room and work out a compromise piece of legislation that took care of all of the interests. Senator Bryant was quite adamant that we weren't allowed out of the room until a compromise was reached by all parties. And there was a balancing act done between at that time, case law was a party that settled would not be on the verdict form, and that got changed. Joint and several was modified as to liability, percentages of when reallocation would be considered, the dollar-for-dollar credit versus the new comparative fault percentage as far as what a defendant would be liable for, were all hard-fought, and I would suggest compromises by all of the interested parties in 1995. As Mr. Alexander says, we have no case law right now on the reallocation proceeding whatsoever. And I, like him, agree. I didn't even know of a horror story or a result having to do with the reallocation proceeding. But it's there as part of the Uniform Modified for Oregon Comparative Fault Act, which formed the basis of the committee's work at the time. I have for the committee a letter from Robert Neuberger. And Mr. Neuberger, along with Tom Tung, who is a defense practitioner primarily in the Duncarney firm in Portland and presently under consideration as a nominee for the federal bench, were sort of the two-point people that shuffled between all of the interest groups in 1995. And I have attached to Mr. Neuberger's letter a memorandum to the Senate Judiciary Committee dated 5/10/1995. See if we can get the Senate Judiciary Committee stamp from the time. And it walks through some of the objections that were raised to the first version of SB 601. It talks about the issue of the joint and several and who should appropriately shoulder the amount of fault in an individual case. It talks about settlements, some of the objections raised to whether they should be or should not be on the verdict form, and what parties need to be identified and when they need to be identified so that the jury could consider all the parties that potentially were at fault. Attached to that is the memorandum that Mr. Neuberger submitted to Senator Neil Bryant, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, dated May 25, 1995, having to do with the A engrossed Senate Bill 601, the final compromise. And again, throughout this memorandum, which runs about seven pages or so, all of the issues that you heard about over the last couple, last week and perhaps yesterday, and the concerns that are being raised now were raised, and they were all carefully compromised. Everybody's interests were protected. Injured party, defendant, and as Representative Anderson said, poor people, rich people, everybody's interests were considered at that time. We see no reason why Senate Bill, House Bill 2492 or 2497 are necessary given the state of Oregon law on this subject right now. I would just hand both of these up for the committee.
Thank you. Are there questions of the committee for the panel? Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Did you have more, Rich?
Mr. Chairman, I'll be staying briefly for two more bills.
Okay.
But I'm moving right along.
All right.
Thank
you
very
much.
You
can stay if you want to, Mick.
Well, I may.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Lane, and I am here to discuss OTLA's opposition to House Bill 2496, the Collateral Source Rule Amendments. I know we talked briefly, or Practice and Procedures spoke briefly about the Collateral Source Rule, but for the committee's benefit, I'd like to explain what we're talking about. Many people, either individually or through an employer or through a union or through some sort of trust situation or under contract, obtain many types of benefits as part of an employment package, primarily. Those benefits can be health care coverage. They could be life insurance benefits. You're actually protected by workers' comp on the job, those benefits. So there's various sorts of what has been characterized as collateral sources in our day-to-day existence. If you are injured or die as a result of somebody's tort, those benefits come into play. You may obtain health care coverage, life insurance benefits may be paid, workers' compensation, disability is awarded to you. All of those benefits pay immediately. If the injured party decides to pursue an action against somebody at fault, nearly every one of these policies, either contractually or statutorily, have clauses regarding the reimbursement and the subrogation of any of those collateral sources paid. There is a scheme in place so that nobody obtains a double recovery. If you are able to obtain through a lawsuit, a judgment, or a settlement certain medical benefits that have been paid on your behalf in the interim, your carrier wants those dollars back. And I've set out in my written material which I will now hand up to the committee. Just one example of the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon language, which says that if benefits are paid and the injured party, if there is another person that is or may be liable for the accident, injury, sickness, or condition that resulted in benefits being paid, those benefits have to be paid back. So you've got a simple system where people are compensated for their medical bills immediately. Medical health care providers are paid for their services, and then if, in the event a judgment is had, those benefits are paid back. Workers' compensation benefits, the exact same way except statutorily. If benefits are paid, then the workers' compensation carrier has a lien on any recovery for the amount of benefits paid. Statutorily, you're not allowed to mention the workers' compensation coverage that you received. It says it right in ORS 656. The fact that you are obtaining those benefits is not admissible. The collateral source rule in Oregon has always been the fact that you have obtained some collateral source payment is not admissible at trial. And I've cited one case in my materials because it's confusing, misleading, it may be used for an improper purpose, and it's prejudicial. It's got nothing to do with fault. Now, in 1987, when we suffered another medical malpractice crisis, we changed the collateral source rule. And the collateral source rule now permits any defendant, after a verdict is rendered, to move the court to reduce the amount of the verdict before a judgment is entered for the amount of any collateral sources. There's an opportunity, there's a procedure in place. More than likely, though, there is no collateral source because of, as I described, this reimbursement scheme that is out there, either contractually or statutorily. The United States government, if it pays under its TRICARE program for military beneficiaries or other employees, has a right to file an action on its own behalf for any benefits paid. It also has a reimbursement provision. They get it covered both ways. In my experience, almost no known collateral source benefit that doesn't have some kind of clause seeking the reimbursement. And I'm not sure what benefits 2496 is actually aimed at, what this problem is, apparently, that requires us to inform the jury and have the jury consider this evidence. The other problem with HB 2496 is that the proponents apparently recognize that there's a subrogation issue in almost all of these situations because the Section 4 moves to prohibit such a reimbursement right under any type of collateral source. Now, speaking about the government's benefits, I doubt this committee can pass any legislation that is going to supersede the United States government's right to have its benefits paid back under a federal program. We've already discussed ERISA. Many employer-paid programs are governed by federal law and probably preempt any type of state law that would prohibit the reimbursement right. And as I believe Representative Shetterly said, and I commented in my materials, what you're going to see, because I don't believe that clause can be effective, is a double whammy. The jury is going to be informed you're getting paid all of these benefits. They're going to reduce the amount of award for those benefits. And yet the injured party is going to have to pay back those benefits. And where are they going to come from? They're going to come from either some other wage or some other non-economic damage. But there's going to be a claim for those benefits. Alternatively, you're going to have many carriers going after the original defendant saying, you didn't pay the benefits that we paid for. You're going to increase litigation. There's going to be an awful lot of fighting going on. The other interesting point about this bill is it only applies to judgments. Now, we've heard last week and yesterday that the majority of medical malpractice cases are settled or there's attempts to settle the case well before a trial. Now what are you facing if 2496 became law? On the one hand, plaintiff has got no assurance whether the collateral source benefits do or do not have to be repaid. And you've got the insurer on the other side saying, I'm not going to settle with you. I might as well try the case because I'm going to get a mandatory credit over there. So you're asking too much. So you're not going to have settlement. You're going to have trial just to have this issue resolved. Lastly, if the situation becomes that insurance carriers, health care benefits, Blue Cross Blue Shield, insurance carriers, Safe, Liberty Northwest, aren't seeing their medical bills paid, reimbursed out of from the wrongful party, you're going to see rates climb. It has to be. They're not getting they're not getting the benefits that they've paid back to maintain the applicable limits for any other policy holder in the state. We think for all those reasons, 2496 is an ill-conceived and unwarranted idea for Oregon. Questions, or
are there questions? We're going to run out of time, and there are four more groups that we want to bring up here before we're done. So,
Mr. Chairman, this is going to be a very quick one because I think we probably I'll leave our objection, Oregon Trial Lawyers' objection to 2498 having to do with interest amendments. I went back and searched through the Oregon revised statutes and found that the last interest rate change in Oregon was from 6 to 9% in 1979. 24 years we've been able to live with an interest rate that applied across the board of 9%. Through bear market, through bull market, through recession, through good times when people were not getting paid nearly enough on whatever they were appealing. I don't see that there's any reason to revisit this for any purpose now. It's worked pretty well for 24 years. And if it's going to apply, I don't think it should be applied to one special interest class, but should be applied across the board.
Okay, good.
And I'll hand this up, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Rich. Are there questions for Mr. Lyon before we bring up the next panel? Okay, next up, Dave Miller, Jerry Sagan, Bob Junda. And I appreciate you gentlemen being patient and just remind you that we're under a bit of a time constraint, so if you can deviate from your written testimony and make your points briefly, and to the extent you want to just chime in and agree with what other people have said, that's helpful. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave Miller again. I will place over here my written materials, which are actually largely duplicates of what I submitted yesterday. There was limited copies, and I brought more today. As I explained yesterday, I've spent the bulk of my career defending doctors in Oregon. Currently, I spend a significant amount of time representing patients in medical malpractice cases. My partner and a good segment of my firm continues to do defense work full time, defending police officers and other public employees in this state. While I was defending cases, I had the privilege, really, of trying 10 to 15 medical malpractice cases a year, year in, year out, throughout the state. The results in my cases mirrored those of other defense counsel and demonstrated that health care providers prevail in Oregon at trial close to 90% of the time. Now, I would add that in all of those cases, there were qualified experts testifying for the plaintiff opposite me. And I would just diverge a bit and ask this question. As I've sat here for 2 days now, feeling like my witnesses must feel in the courtroom as they're cooling their heels out in the hallway, I've heard terms bandied about. And if you consider that 90% or so of medical cases in Oregon come down in favor of the defendant, does this mean that all of those cases are the so-called frivolous cases, a term we've heard bandied about recently? If so, then I would suggest that the relatively few cases that result in plaintiff's verdicts were cases in which the defenses were frivolous. And is that the case? I don't think so. Yesterday, I listened to the statement read by Dr. Bowen, a Salem obstetrician, and today Drs. Bernardo and Johnson, in which they attributed their liability insurance rates to decisions made by jurors, whom, at least in Dr. Bowen's case, claim do not understand the evidence they hear and are unduly sympathetic toward patients who sue their doctors. Because these physicians' comments were made in the context of discussing the package of bills proposed here, including House Bill 2595, the contingent fee bill, I can only assume that these arguments are those which the proponents of the bill offer in support of its passage. For that reason, I would ask this committee to strongly look at and consider whether those arguments are accurate, and justify these dramatic changes. If, as the physicians claim, the legislation is necessary to protect Oregon doctors from the legal system, you have to consider the source of the perceived problem the proponents seek protection from. A question was asked yesterday, I believe, by Representative Crummell about whether health care providers, physicians, nurses, and others, sit on juries in medical malpractice cases. The point, I suppose, was that physicians are not being judged by their colleagues, and this suggests a certain element of unfairness. I think it's fair to say that it is a rare trial of any kind. If you were to go to any courthouse throughout this state where you'd find a physician as a prospective juror, be it a criminal case or a civil case. I think it's also fair to say that most lawyers representing patients in malpractice cases would exercise their right to excuse physicians from service on a jury judging the case of another physician. Similarly, I can assure you that defense lawyers go to great lengths, as I did, and sometimes great expense, to study the type of people that would be favorable jurors for their client, the physician, or the hospital. I've participated in focus groups paid for by the insurance industry in which literally thousands of dollars were expended determining what types of jurors would be more favorable toward the defense in a given case. Just as physicians will be excused from a jury by the plaintiff's attorneys, patients who are dissatisfied with their medical care will likely be excused by defense attorneys. It's this adversarial process of jury selection conducted in Oregon by some of the most experienced trial attorneys we have which leads to the selection of a jury that hears a given case. No juror serves unless he or she swears to be fair and impartial. So if you accept the premise that it's the juries which are the source of the physician's economic troubles, which, by the way, is a premise I do not accept, you cannot ignore the decisions of those juries. Given the overwhelming success physicians and hospitals have when they try medical malpractice cases here, it's difficult to accept the plea that the occasional verdict in favor of a patient justifies the distrust of the entire system. If you want to appreciate the truth of the point I'm making, do this. Ask an experienced medical malpractice defense attorney or even a claim representative at Northwest Physicians Mutual or CNA here in Oregon whether they would rather have one of their cases determined by a judge or a jury. And the answer you will get demonstrates my point. Without hesitation, the answer will be a jury. For to say otherwise would be subjecting their client to a 90% risk that they will lose. It's also important to remember that when physicians speak of their professional distress over viewing their patients as potential adversaries, they are not mindful of the fact that those same patients are prospective jurors. They are the same people that make the decisions which have elected each of you to the seats you hold. They are the same people that come to my office in search of representation, or more often information about what has happened to them or a family member. The real question that this proposed set of bills ignores, but which obviously underlies the proponent's reasoning, is this. Why do impartial jurors make the decisions they make? Shouldn't the financial effort that's being spent behind this package of legislation be focused on how medical care can be improved and losses prevented, rather than on how to reduce the exposure for those who cause the losses? The contingent fee bill, House Bill 2595, seeks to lower and limit fees that lawyers and clients can agree to. The idea of a contingent fee has been approved by courts throughout this country since the early 19th century. In my written materials, you'll see I've made reference to law review articles which have discussed the history of that process. And this is important because the reasoning behind this method of charging for services applies today just as it did in the 19th century. The phrases you see referred to in the packet, if you read the packet, or if you refer to the law review articles, quote judicial phrases like the contingent fee being a poor man's key to the courthouse, and that it's the price of right, the price of what is right, is too high for a poor man. They apply just as much today as they did then. The contingent fee is a simple tool. And remember, it's one used not just in medical malpractice cases. It's used in many other legal relationships throughout our system. A lawyer agrees to accept the client's case, and thus the risk of losing, in exchange for receiving a percentage of the recovery. In addition, the lawyer typically agrees to advance costs on behalf of the client in order to allow the case to be pursued. In my opinion, it's understanding the extent of these costs that's important to understanding why the proposed fee schedule in House Bill 2595 would effectively eliminate representation for many people and not bring about the effect desired by the proponents. The ingredient that historically has justified the use of contingent fees is risk. Because the vast majority of people can't afford to pay attorneys a reasonable hourly rate throughout the course of a malpractice case, any more than they can afford to pay for their own medical and hospital care today, contingent fees allow people to have access to their system, their judicial system, by their attorney risking loss of his or her time in exchange for the potential of a recovery. As I noted earlier, when the risk of losing is approximately 90% in Oregon, the risk is very real. Now, costs. It's most easily understood if you turn to the bill by looking at the initial proposed contingent fee of 40% on cases which lead to a recovery of less than $50,000. Now, to those of us that have spent our entire career working in the medical malpractice context, in my case on both sides, I can tell you without reservation that today the idea of a $50,000 medical malpractice case is almost unheard of. The cost of trying a case that yields less than $50,000 could easily come close to, if not exceed, that very amount. Expert witnesses, which are required in medical malpractice cases, not optional, charge by the hour. Some charge a flat fee. And again, I'm not describing the experts that fly in and out of Portland, in my case, Portland, and testify and then head off to another trial somewhere. And those experts are out there. I'm talking about experts who live, vote, pay taxes right here in Oregon with the rest of us. These costs to pay the expert must be reimbursed by the client in the event of a verdict or settlement. Once the experts are paid, the result for the client recovering less than $50,000 is simply not economically viable. For that reason, those cases are indeed few and far between. I would also point out, having defended cases for so long, that if the cost of defending a $50,000 case through trial would almost assuredly exceed the 40% proposed contingent fee, which is $20,000. If the true intent of the proposal is to maximize where the premium dollar is paid, are we next going to restrict what defense counsel can bill for defending their cases? If I were a physician confronted with a malpractice case, I surely would not want my lawyer telling me that he or she cannot hire a given expert or put on whatever evidence they might believe is appropriate to get me off the hook because of an artificial limit that's been put on what I can charge the carrier. Similarly, a fee of $125,000 on a $500,000 recovery, which is the second element of the proposed statute, may seem like a large fee. However, one with regard to legal fees, needs to consider them against the amount of time spent on the case. Again, compare the costs to defend the same case at an hourly rate. A fee this large to defend a case worth $500,000 is not out of line with what defense costs are in this marketplace. If the goal is to curtail costs, the proposed limit on what a plaintiff's attorney can charge invites similar limits on what the defense is paying. And those are the same dollars that are spent and therefore not available for the people who've been injured. The final category of fee is 15% on awards in excess of $550,000, a number which presumably is derived from some other statute somewhere, but which obviously is arbitrary. An award of $550,000 would yield under this proposal a fee of $89,000, roughly. Interestingly, that fee is significantly less than the fee earned on a smaller award in the other category. Again, if you assume a trial of 6 or 7 days and a case that's pending for 2 years, the hourly rate works out to something significantly less than an attorney could charge if he were litigating other types of cases in other fields. And this, of course, is the unstated yet obvious goal of this statute: to eliminate the incentive of plaintiff's attorneys to represent patients in medical malpractice cases. Depriving people of competent lawyers to handle these cases will keep people from having access to the system. I've not specifically addressed the legal and other practical considerations that argue against this bill. I make reference to them in the written materials. The freedom of lawyers, like any professional, to engage in contract is a fundamental right. When financial advisors and corporations' accountants come to you in the next session and ask for similar legislation, or when the airline industry comes and seeks protection from claims arising from negligently caused airline disasters, is the solution to throw up disincentives to the people injured by the wrongs committed, or should the focus be on why the wrongs are being committed? For all of those reasons, I would urge the committee to reject this bill for the benefit of those who are injured by these events which do occur.
Thank you, Mr. Sagan.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hello, my name is Jerry Sagan. As a victim of medical negligence, I would like to express my view as to why House Bill 2495 is an unjust to medical malpractice victims. My wife, Mary Sagan, was a healthy 45-year-old woman who died 6 years ago. Her death was a result of a lethal combination of prescription drugs and an antihistamine and antibiotic, both common drugs. The physician's desk reference and both pharmaceutical companies warned against the potential combination. It took 10 months and the intervention of a state representative to prod the state of Oregon medical examiners to obtain a blood test proving cause of death. My first attorney contact was with an Atlanta attorney, James Sifter, an acknowledged expert with similar case experience. Mr. Sifter told me that it really didn't matter how good my case was because it wouldn't be economically feasible to litigate against the world's largest drug companies and a doctor in a state that has non-economic limits of $500,000 in wrongful death. I interviewed 3 top Oregon law firms, all warned of the difficulty ahead in challenging the medical community and the malpractice insurance. After choosing an attorney, part of the case was settled, and I was left to seek the accountability from the negligent doctor. The medical malpractice insurers are a juggernaut of money and power. Let me ask you, who has the advantage in a lawsuit? Is the litigant that has unlimited capital to hire the best law firm at an hourly rate, paying all expenses, win or lose? Is it the litigant of unlimited resources with the ability to procure the best expert witness on retainers for repeated bases of testimony? Now, I imagine the medical victim. Do you see them having the financial ability to pay a law firm by the hour? Very few could. Do you see them having the money to advance expenses? Is justice to be only for the wealthy? Now imagine a law firm representing a medical negligent victim. Your client most likely does not have the ability to advance the $20,000 to $100,000 plus to pay costs of expert witnesses, fees, depositions, medical investigations, trial exhibits, travel expenses, jury fees, etc. As an attorney, what expenses can you advance against a possible verdict? How many hours can you work without the certainty of payment? What expenses can you ever recover from a client if you lose your case? What if during your trial your client chooses to settle for a lesser amount than you think is possible because of fear? Or worse, what if your client refuses a good recommended offer and you lose everything? The medical insurer is a sophisticated client. The victim is not. What victim's law firm would rather take a case at an hourly rate, expenses paid by client, would rather not take a case at hourly pay? The contingency system advances only the best cases. Many good cases are left behind. What victim can reasonably appeal a good case lost? The insurance industry has the money to appeal or threaten to appeal on most, if not all, cases, hoping to settle, as they often do, for a lesser verdict. Victims are not on equal footing. They cannot afford the threat of loss. Victims' attorneys cannot afford to retry a case for the same fee already earned. I can speak with great certainty about the processing of Mary's legal case. I spent the majority of 2 years speaking to every and any research specialist nationwide, FDA officials, laboratories, writers, and victims. I believe that I had a major role in the withdrawal of a dangerous drug from the marketplace. I worked with my attorneys on an almost a daily basis for more than a year. Two or more attorneys, a paralegal, a staff medical nurse, a legal secretary, typing staff, and others worked on my case. The judgment against the responsible doctor was entered. It was settled for on appeal for less. Under House Bill 2495, the proposed limitation of attorney fees, my attorney would have received approximately $160,000. Do any of you think that a law firm can advance $70,000 in expert witnesses and related litigation expense for the possibility of earning this amount? I know I spent at least 3 hours in direct contact with my legal 300 hours in direct contact with my legal team. I would estimate that $160,000 is a pittance as to what their hourly rate would have been. My attorney has said that that amount is two-thirds less than their billing hour basis would be. Anyone with financial acumen should be able to see that this is not a sustainable system for the victim. I am not an advocate for attorneys. I'm an advocate for medical negligence victims. House Bill 2495 is a thinly veiled attempt to deny medical negligent victims the right to adequate, competent representation. The contingency fee system offers, as Mr. Miller has said before, the keys to the courthouse to many victims. Reducing the legal fees will tilt the already unlevel playing field, the courthouse, further towards the medical community and their insurers. Who's going to regulate the legal expense of the insurers? This bill places no limitation on the money the medical liability insurer pays the defense attorney. This bill is designed to impair the malpractice victim's ability to hire competent, skilled, experienced lawyers. There is no outcry from the consumer victims about this bill. Justice is about equal access to the law. I hope that all of you will vote against this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Sagan. Mr. Judith.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Chundeff. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. I'm speaking in opposition to House Bill 2495. Our organization provides free legal services to people with disabilities. It's very rare that we conduct tort litigation, and so I'm not really speaking toward our own organization's financial interest, but more towards the people who call us looking for legal representation to address their injuries. We provide normally about 3,000 units of information referral per year for people with disabilities calling us from around the state with a variety of legal issues, many of whom we refer to the Oregon State Bar or private attorneys. This year, I think that number is going to be much higher since right now we're running about 2 weeks behind in returning calls because of the effects of some of the budget cuts in Oregon. However, I digress. What we're concerned about really is just that folks are able to have access to legal services to resolve their legitimate claims, and we're concerned that this bill will prevent that. Secondly, for those who are unable to obtain a fair settlement of a legitimate claim, those people will fall back upon public services, which, as we all know, are more and more limited. And for those reasons, we would oppose House Bill 2495.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Are there questions? Representative Brzezinski.
Just a comment. I want to thank Mr. Sagan for coming up and sharing his story with us. I know he's done this before in the sense of trying to make individuals aware, and I know you drove up today to do so. Thank you.
Any further? Next up, we have Tony Alfieri and Linda McCathren. We've still got two more panels after that, so I'm going to strongly encourage... No? No, Linda, just Mr. Alfieri. Okay, that's fine. Just encourage everyone to be as brief as possible because we're going to lose our committee here if we're not quick. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Anthony Alfieri. I am by profession a structured settlement planner and the vice president of Settlement Professionals based out of Lake Oswego, Oregon. I'm here today to oppose House Bill 2591 from Settlement Professionals and myself for the following reasons. I'll also be referencing Internal Revenue Code Section 5891, so in case I do reference that, I'm not transposing numbers. We oppose House Bill 2591 for the following reasons. It does not include any statement of purpose or public policy by which the proposed legislation can be justified or evaluated. It does not include any procedural guidance or standards for fashioning a verdict with the factual information necessary for a judge to evaluate an installment judgment. It fails to reference or properly integrate the current tax law, and that specifically is provision 5891, which has now set forth a specific definition of structured settlements, which includes periodic payment of judgments. It makes no reference to Internal Revenue Code Section 130, which is the qualified assignment section, which is the preferred method identified in the Internal Revenue Code for financing future periodic payments. It does not specifically address how defendants will receive a full and final release. It includes such items as property damage that receive no structured settlement tax benefits under the Internal Revenue Code. It does not deal with how punitive damages are to be paid. It makes no provision for calculating how attorneys are to be paid. Currently, as written, it appears to require at least some portion of attorneys to be paid by future installments. The security features included in House Bill 2591 do not follow industry best practices for protecting claimants against non-payment or insolvency by the obligor. The mandatory features of House Bill 2591 would require some plaintiffs who need a lump sum judgment to accept and receive installment payments. After working with a multitude of claimants over the past few years, not all plaintiffs or claimants are appropriate candidates for structured settlements or future periodic payments. The only benchmark in House Bill 2591 as to whether or not a plaintiff must accept future periodic payments is the amount the defendant is going to have to pay for specific damages. it does not consider what's in the best interest of the plaintiff. The needs and circumstances of each plaintiff vary greatly. To propose legislation that does not take into account the uniqueness of each plaintiff's circumstances will likely cause more inequities than it is trying to solve. In some instances, a claimant may need to structure more, or in some instances, less than what's required by this statute. And I can have trouble thinking of, over the claimants we've dealt with, the claimants that would fit within this statute over the past years in its precision or its, as it's written. And there's no financial criteria established or regulatory authority for qualifying product providers for periodic payment of judgments. In sum, this one-size-fits-all approach is flawed and will cause more inequities than it intends to solve. For these reasons, settlement professionals and myself are opposed to House Bill 2591 and urge the committee to vote against it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Were there any questions for Mr. Alfieri? Thank you. Lynn Marie Kreider. Is she here, or is she left? And we've got her testimony. She submitted it to the committee, and I'd note it, colleagues, to you on the record. Scott Heiser from the District Attorneys Association. Scott, we have your written testimony as well, but go ahead and come forward, and you can put what you need to put on the record. I'd encourage you not to read us your testimony.
I assure you I will not. Thank you. The DA's Association isn't on either side of the malpractice debate in Oregon. We're here because we're concerned about a potential change to the evidence code. That's House Bill 2493. To correct something that I believe was said twice yesterday, House Bill 2493 is not an exact copy of the federal rule, Rule 702. It's derived from, but it is not an exact copy. Pardon me, please. The third factor in the rule regarding the reliability of the witness as applied to the facts of the case versus as applied to the facts or data on which the testimony is based is the discrepancy in the language, and though a subtle difference could have profound effects on appeal. What you're doing here, if you adopt House Bill 2493, is in effect codifying case law, which shifts the focus on appeal from developing the body of case law already in the works to construing a statute, thus limiting what the Court of Appeals or the State Supreme Court can do as a gatekeeper construing the evidence on expert testimony. I'd encourage you to be mindful of that. Most specifically for the DA's Association, thank you. Most specifically of concern for the DA's Association is the fact that if this committee or this body, the legislature, were to adopt House Bill 2493, that would open the door to relitigating all the previously recognized as valid science in the state of Oregon, particularly forensic evidence regarding DNA, fingerprint testing, ballistics, blood splatter, and the like. So my organization is strongly recommending this bill die in committee, and so we urge you to vote against it when it does come to that point in time. I'd be happy to take any questions, and I apologize for rushing. I know you're short on time.
So thank you very much for the brevity of your testimony. Are there questions for Mr. Heiser? We have his written testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next, I'm going to call up three of you in a panel, but not because you're together, but just because it will make the committee move quicker. Bill Syme from the OADC, John Powell from Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, and Fred Van Atta. Is Fred still here?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bill Syme, and I am here today as a representative of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. We are a group of lawyers who defend civil claims that are brought against individuals and companies. Many of our members represent physicians in hospitals and medical legal issues and in the defense of medical malpractice cases. And as I said last week, I think we bring kind of a unique perspective and experience to this debate. We're not here trying to carry the interests of doctors or hospitals or insurers. However, interested in the integrity of the process. And there are only two bills I wanted to address. One is House Bill 2497. And the other is House Bill 2494. I don't have written materials prepared, I certainly am going to prepare them, submit them, basically post-hearing to you. 2497 pertains to the comparative fault statute and proposes an amendment to that. Under current law, the jury can consider the fault of the plaintiff and the defendants and third-party defendants and any party who has settled with the plaintiff. The plaintiff initially has the burden of proving the claim against the defendants. The defendant brings in another party who they think is responsible. That defendant has the burden of proving that, either as to a third-party defendant or as to a settled party. That is the current state of the law. The first part of House Bill 2497 would expand the universe of people who can be considered by the jury in allocating fault to include a person who is not a party to the litigation and who has not settled with a plaintiff. And candidly, as a part of our organization, we're looking at that's not necessary, because if I am defending a case and I look at there's a party out there that I think should be joined, I have the ability to do that now under third-party practice. So that first part of the bill we're not advocating as an organization. The second part of that bill is absolutely critical. And if this committee and this legislature does nothing on the rest of the tort package, candidly, that's probably okay with us as an organization. But this is something that is essential and crucial and should be passed out of committee and should be passed as part of the whole by the legislature. And I tell you where the problem arises. And as we are defending these cases, both kind of garden variety tort claims, but also particularly medical malpractice cases, keep in mind that it is the plaintiff's burden of proof to prove the negligence or fault of the defendants. And imagine this scenario where you have a medical malpractice case and a claim is brought against the physician and the hospital. In that situation, the plaintiff has the burden of proof on all claims as to the physician and to the hospital, and must hire their experts to prove that case as to standard of care, breach, causation, and damages. Typically, in defending that case, if I'm defending the hospital, I don't go out and hire my experts then to go and try to prove the physician's negligence, and the physician doesn't go out and hire experts to try to prove the hospital's negligence. We basically try to take the case as it is. You don't point fingers to the other defendants, and you defend your own party. To do anything different is essentially, and it's counterproductive. So that is how these cases are defended as a practical matter. The real problem that exists now involves this scenario. It was not anticipated and was not considered when the joint and several liability rules were changed in 1995. And it's a situation where during the week before trial, and incidentally, this is based upon real-life experience upon some recent cases. It's a situation where the case settles right before trial against the physician only, say for $1 million. And that the plaintiff wants to proceed to trial as against the hospital only as the sole remaining defendant. Under current law, that the hospital does not get any sort of credit or offset for the amount of that $1 million settlement. In defending that hospital, you then must make a decision. Am I going to now hire my own experts to try to prove the physician's negligence or fault in causing the injury to the plaintiff? And how does that affect me in the direct defense of the hospital? And many of the times you're faced with allegations against the hospital that they were negligent in selecting and retaining the physician on the medical staff, or in this particular instance were negligent in not intervening into the physician's care. And for the hospital to defend that case by going out and hiring experts to try to prove the physician's negligence obviously is very counterproductive. But it's impossible to do at the last minute when you have a settlement before trial, or for that matter, during trial. So that case then proceeds to trial against the hospital only, and there is a judgment, say, for $1 million. And what you now have is a situation where there's a double recovery by the plaintiff. In other words, they have gone ahead and pleaded and proved 100% of what their damages are. They get to keep the benefit of the $1 million settlement they got against the physician, and they get to keep the benefit of the $1 million settlement that they then got against the hospital. Candidly, that's not correct and that's not right. the double recovery aspect of it. It's not fair to put the defendant there in that position on the last minute sale, either before trial or during trial, of having to scramble then to find experts to try to prove the physician's negligence or the settled party's negligence when that's not something that you reasonably anticipated you're going to have to be required to do. So the second part of House Bill 2497, and you can find it in subsection 4, gives the defendant then the right to make an election. You either, at trial, prove the negligence of the settled defendant and as a means to reduce your own liability, you don't get the benefit of the amount that was paid in settlement, or you waive the right to try to prove the percentage of the settling defendant and therefore reduce your own percentage, but you get a credit for the settlement. And, Kenley, that's the only fair way to approach it, and this is something that should be adopted. There may be some questions about the timing of the election. Mr. Alexander has discussed that with me privately, and certainly that's something we're willing to try to work to reach consensus upon. The issue about multiple defendants remaining and how do you handle that? Well, if there's multiple defendants remaining and you have to allocate the settled some responsibility to the settled defendant, then you're going to have an allocation of responsibility between the remaining defendants and the settled defendants, and everyone's going to should be responsible at that point to pay for their own percentage of fault. But that's, again, an issue that can be fine-tuned. The central, the core function, the core idea of the second part of this is really, really important and should go through. And I'm willing to work with this committee or anyone else to try to, if there's some language that needs to be modified or some adjustments that need to be made, I'm certainly willing to do that.
Bill, you'll send us a letter or you'll outline your testimony in written form for us?
Absolutely, yes.
Good, thank you.
I'm sorry, with the press of private practice over the last couple of days, I have not had a chance to do that. I would like to talk about House Bill 2494, which relates to expert disclosure. This is something that is not unanimous agreement among the members of our organization about the issue of expert disclosure. It is not unanimous agreement among the plaintiff's bar either. I can tell you that the OADC board has taken a position that they support the idea of expert disclosure and limited expert discovery, not in all cases, but to set some sort of threshold amount, say, for example, when the prayer exceeds $100,000 or $250,000, or you pick a number. But for the large cases involving significant injury or death, that these are cases that properly should have expert disclosure. You get a better result. It promotes settlement. It avoids the concept of trial by ambush. It improves quality of the system tremendously. And I do want to make this point because I've heard the arguments in opposition to the concept of expert disclosure. And part of it is it's because we've always done it that way in Oregon. Part of it is a concern that somehow that we're going to federalize the entire system, or look at the cost of defending a case in federal court compared to the cost of defending a case in state court. It is true that probably given the same case, defending that under the federal rules and defending that under the state court rules, the federal case is going to be more expensive. But there's a lot to that that goes beyond expert disclosure because of the significant differences in the two systems. You're going to have expenses from interrogatories and pretrial orders and everything else that's involved in the federal system that have nothing to do with the expert disclosure. The cost of the experts is derived from actually going out and retaining experts and having them review the files and preparing a written report for you for your own use that you can rely upon in your evaluation of the claim. The real cost is not from doing the expert disclosure. That is relatively minimal in the overall scheme of things. And some of that is essentially a paralegal function in preparing the disclosure. So by requiring limited expert disclosure and discovery, you're not creating a materially greater cost in the whole system, particularly in the larger cases where you need to have the experts anyway. And I submit to you that the benefits from that, as far as promoting settlement and a fair process, greatly outweigh the minimal additional cost of preparing the disclosure. Another argument in opposition to this expert disclosure has been that somehow you're going to discourage people from coming forward and willing to serve as experts, and I submit to you that there is no shortage of experts in the federal system. There's no shortage of experts in the 48 other states or so. Before an expert agrees to take a case and to testify, they're going to know that in all these other states that eventually their name is going to be disclosed and there's going to be some limited discovery there. It does not impair the ability to get experts in other states, and I submit to you that if we adopt the concept of limited expert discovery and expert disclosure in Oregon, that that's not going to have a chilling effect on the ability of the plaintiff's bar or the defense bar to get their experts that they need to defend the cases. I'll leave it at that. If you have an additional question, that certainly won't.
Great. Thank you very much, Bill. Mr. Powell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you're very patient, and those of us who have been waiting for 2 days to testify appreciate that probably as much as you do. I don't wish any committee member ill, but it would be interesting if this committee had somebody with Tourette's syndrome. It would probably speed the dialogue along as they express their real feelings as people testify. Let me simply state the opposition of Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield to House Bill 2496. The real victim of this bill are the payers of health insurance premium, because in effect, that's what the bill does, is shift these costs from the wrongdoer and their insurer to an innocent party who is paying the bill for the injured party. And we simply oppose that for the four bullet points that are listed on your testimony, and I will not read those to you. But as most of you know, people are falling out of our health insurance system by the day because of costs. Any cost increases in that system will be detrimental to the health insurance coverage of Oregonians. For those reasons, we would oppose. I have several other clients that if this bill is amended, as the attorneys for the Oregon Medical Association pointed out yesterday, to all civil cases, I will have about nine other interests who would like to testify if that amendment is in fact introduced, because they would oppose it as well. So for those reasons, this page is nice and succinct, and I will not bore you with more rhetoric. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Powell, and for the brevity and clarity of your testimony. And Representative Shetterly does have Tourette's syndrome, but we have him sufficiently medicated.
Medicated.
I think I know who's paying that bill.
Fred, can you testify quicker than John did on your point?
I can, sir. Fred Venata, on behalf of Liberty Northwest Companies. I know there's been some discussion of the subrogation issue. I just want to point out the cost shift that occurs in where there's a workers' comp case involved, in particularly in the case of a self-insured employer, that cost is shifted 100% to the self-insured employer. And in Liberty's case, where we use largely loss-sensitive policies, the costs are largely shifted to the injured worker's employer. If it's a straight policy, obviously it's shifted to general employers, but the employer in case has a mod rate that they carry with them for some period of time. We would ask you if you believe that's a good policy to shift from the party that causes the problem to innocent parties. If you do decide to go forward with the bill, you should look at the conflict it creates with 656-593, which are the lien rights for the workers' comp carriers in these kinds of cases. We urge you to leave the bill here.
That was good. I was envisioning that the committee would have like the little judges things, that at the end of the testimony we could hold up the score. But I think you came in under John's time there, Fred, so that was good. That was fine. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Crumwell gives you a six. Are there questions for the panel? Okay. Hearing none, thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. And Bill, you'll get your comments in writing submitted to the committee. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Appreciate the committee's indulgence in sticking around after the time frame. And for those of you who testified today as well, we'll now close all the public hearings that we opened at the beginning of the meeting and adjourn the committee for the afternoon.